Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, August 20th, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi. In today's weather, the high will be 89, with a chance of storms late in the day, overnight low around 70. The lead story on the front page of today's Gazette is written by Marissa Payne and titled, Dreams of Signature CR Rec Hub Coming True. With $20 million fundraising complete, Cedar Lake worked to start this fall. A decades-long dream of revitalizing Cedar Lake as the hub of a signature recreational project connecting trails and neighborhoods in Cedar Rapids is finally coming to life. For years, the vision fueling Connect CR, the grassroots group leading the charge to reimagine the lake just north of downtown and construct a pedestrian-like bridge spanning the Cedar River to the south, seemed shaky. Some questioned whether the volunteers could raise enough money to bring the infrastructure project with a $20 million price tag to reality. It turns out they could. Connect CR team members Thursday shared finalized plans for a bridge design and confirmed all the needed funding is locked in to see the project through and break ground this fall at Cedar Lake. Final engineering plans are to be completed for the bridge in summer or fall of 2022, with construction planned for 2023 and 2024. The Connect CR project is slated to wrap up by 2025. Mike McGrath, chair of the Connect CR Implementation Committee, said a recent anonymous $1 million contribution put the team far over the edge of its $7.2 million private fundraising goal, past $8 million. That money is in addition to a City of Cedar Rapids commitment to the project of $1 million annually for 5 years, a $5 million Hall Perrine Foundation contribution, and a $500,000 State Community Action and Tourism grant. Quote, we are right on top of our budgeted goal, so that this thing is a go, McGrath said. We've been saying that, but we're there, and we're there in all respects, so it's really exciting and just amazing that the community has really rallied and put us in this position, end quote. Rising material costs and safety issues prompted modifications to the bridge near the base of Mount Trashmore, which replaces an old railroad bridge that was washed away in the 2008 flood. It will span the Cedar River, connecting the Newbow and Check Village neighborhoods with a 23-foot-wide path free of vehicle traffic. Cedar Rapids contracted with Canadian firm WSP USA for over $1.2 million to provide designs and engineering for amenities at Cedar Lake, the pedestrian bridge, and connecting trails. This firm has done work around the globe, including design and construction of a multi-arch bridge in Vietnam that mimics a fire-breathing dragon. Committee member Steve Sovern, who was involved with earlier bridge designs, said one of the so-called pinch points of the trail system in Linn County was the lack of an incredible pedestrian trail bridge. Quote, we set out to correct that problem, Sovern said. We also knew that it had to be an extraordinary bike and people crossing. It wasn't just a platform to get you from one side of the river to the other, and it had to connect our neighborhoods. The modified bridge design moves the tower to the west side of the bridge and closer to Mount Trashmore. This steel tower will give an industrial feel and support a cable-stayed bridge with a split deck below, which also will move to that side of the river with downtown Cedar Rapids as a backdrop. To light up a darker corner of the community, the tower will have two lighting systems, Sovereign said. One is an LED-lighted internal system, which at night will appear to twinkle and will have multiple color options. The external lighting will flow from the base of the bridge and illuminate the cables as well as the tower itself. This also can be lit in multiple colors to celebrate different holidays. Informational panels honoring the area's industrial and agricultural history, originally planned to be part of the tower in the middle of the bridge, will now be incorporated in landing areas on both sides of the river. These spaces have been redesigned and expanded, creating park-like settings near the entry to the bridge on both sides. In addition to the bridge, Cedar Lake's transformation will include a boardwalk extending over the 120-area lake and handicap-accessible piers. Project plans also involve preserving wetlands on the North Shore, adding paddle sport launch locations, floating islands, and a nature-based playground. For Cedar Rapids, City Council Member Dale Todd, chair of the city's internal Connect CR workgroup, this news was a welcome birthday present. He turned 64 Thursday. Quote, "This has been a community vision of people that came a long time before us," Todd said. "We were just the ones that were lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time to be able to implement it. This is going to become a nice urban fishery that is accessible to everybody and free to everybody, right in the heart of the city." End quote. In another front page article on Friday's Gazette, Michaela Ram writes, "Feds to require shots for nursing home staffs. Facilities risk funding if they don't comply." With COVID-19 vaccinations among employees of nursing homes in Iowa lagging, the facilities, like others across the nation, are expected to be required to mandate doses for their staffs in the coming weeks or risk losing federal funds. The federal policy announced this week was a welcome one for advocacy organizations like AARP Iowa, which have called on vaccine requirements for nursing home workers as the state experiences a new surge in cases being driven by a more transmissible coronavirus variant. Currently, only 22% of the state's nursing homes have at least 75% of their workers vaccinated, said AARP Iowa State Director Brad Anderson. That 75% benchmark was set by the industry itself, he added. Quote, "We are pleased with the news from the White House that nursing home staff will be required to be vaccinated as a condition of receiving federal funds," Anderson said in a statement. Quote, "Today, Iowa nursing homes still have a long way to go to meet the vaccination standards set by the industry. The new federal requirements should help spur much-needed action," end quote. The Biden administration announced Wednesday that staff at nursing homes across the country must be vaccinated against COVID-19, or those facilities could lose funding from the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. That regulation could take effect as soon as next month. The new policy would impact about 15,000 nursing homes, which employ more than 1 million people nationwide. The Iowa Healthcare Association, an advocacy organization for the state's long-term care facilities, said it is assessing the impact this mandate would have on Iowa's 431 nursing homes. Nursing homes across the state employ more than 27,000 individuals, according to the association. Vaccination rates among nursing home staff in Iowa is about 62% overall, according to a dashboard of federal nursing home COVID-19 data compiled by the AARP. However, about 91% of nursing home residents in Iowa are vaccinated, the data shows. Advocates have raised concerns that nursing home residents, among the most vulnerable populations for severe COVID-19 infection, could once again be put at risk during this current surge in new cases. After weeks of no outbreaks following the widespread rollout of vaccines, 4 long-term care facilities in Iowa this week reported a coronavirus outbreak in their facilities. The previous week, 3 facilities reported an outbreak, at least 3 confirmed cases among residents and staff. According to federal data, about 60% of nursing home staff nationwide are vaccinated. By comparison, 82% of residents are immunized against the novel coronavirus. The new policy comes as part of the Biden administration's efforts to increase vaccine rates nationwide as the highly contagious Delta variant spreads rapidly, driving up case counts and hospitalizations, particularly in states with low vaccination rates. One major nursing home association called on the federal mandate to go further. The head of the American Healthcare Association and National Center for Assisted Living, Mark Parkinson, said vaccine mandates should be applied to all healthcare personnel, not just nursing home staff. Some hospitals and other similar entities have taken similar steps with their employees, including the Iowa-based Unity Point Health and Mercy One Health Systems. The Iowa Healthcare Association raised concerns that this directive could have a negative impact on an already strained long-term care workforce in the state. As of mid-July, nearly 24% of Iowa's nursing homes were reporting a shortage of nurses, aides, and other direct care workers, according to the AARP Nursing Home COVID-19 dashboard. Quote, "Reports suggest that the mandate will only apply to nursing homes and not to other healthcare settings," the Iowa Healthcare Association said in a statement. Quote, "If true, such a singling out of nursing homes is counterproductive and will further exacerbate crisis-level workforce shortages in long-term care." End quote. Turning to the Iowa Today section is a photo essay titled Fair Competition. In the largest photo, it shows five elementary school-aged children riding big wheels. And of course, the big wheels are small for the children. And the caption for the photo is, McKenna Cronbaugh, aged 8, of Raymond, won a blue ribbon Thursday in the big wheel races on the Grand Concourse at the Iowa State Fair in Des Moines. The fair runs through Sunday. In another photograph, Elizabeth Stockbauer of Altoona blows a huge bubble during the bubble blowing contest Thursday at the state fair. And from the picture, it appears that she is blowing a bubble with bubble gum. And in the final picture, Brecken Fancher, aged 8, of Grimes, celebrates on Thursday after winning a blue ribbon in a pie contest. And Grancher is shown with his arms raised up, serious look on his face, and a face covered with remnants of what appears to have been a cream pie. James Q. Lynch of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau writes, Bernie Sanders coming to CR. He aims to boost $3.5 trillion spending plan. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders carried the Linn County Democratic caucuses in February 2020, but he's coming back because of Donald Trump's strong performance in the November election. Sanders is coming back to Cedar Rapids to rally support for his $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation proposal. It's one of the Senate Budget Committee chairman's stops on a town hall tour of congressional districts where Trump increased his vote total between 2016 and 2020. Trump carried Iowa in 2016 and 2020, increasing his vote total by nearly 97,000 votes statewide en route to an 8.2 percentage point win over Democrat Joe Biden. He also increased his vote total in the first congressional district, which includes Linn County, by about 20,000 votes from 2016 to 2020. Quote, while it will have no Republican support in Washington, Democrats, independents, and working-class Republicans all over the country support our plan to finally invest in the long-neglected needs of working families, Sanders said in announcing an August 29th town hall at the Nubo City Market Bankers Trust stage, 1100 3rd Street Southeast, starting at 2 p.m. He's planning a similar event in Indiana's 4th District, where Trump increased his vote total by about 30,000 votes in 2020. However, Sanders points to a Data for Progress poll that found support from across the political spectrum for the $3.5 trillion package broadly and the policies in the proposal specifically. First District Representative Ashley Hinson, who outperformed Trump in defeating a Democratic incumbent in 2020, thinks it will be hard for Sanders to justify a, quote, spending spree that will make life even less affordable for working families, end quote. The Democratic budget proposal touches nearly every aspect of American life, Sanders said. It calls for the wealthiest Americans to pay what Sanders calls their, quote, fair share, end quote, of taxes, extends the historic expansion of the child tax credit, guarantees free pre-kindergarten for all 3- and 4-year-olds, and ensures no family pays more than 7% of its income for child care. The proposal also would make community college tuition free, combat climate change, create millions of good-paying jobs, make housing more affordable, expand Medicare to lower the eligibility age and cover eyeglasses, hearing aids, and dental care, and make home health care more affordable. Iowans, Hinson said, quote, are just appalled that the administration and radical Democrats want to spend $3.5 trillion more dollars we don't have on policies Iowans don't want, including paving the way for the death tax and other tax hikes, while inflation is soaring and they are already paying more for everyday life, end quote. Today's Gazette's Nation and World section includes an article from the Associated Press titled Texas Dems Return and 38-Day Holdout. A standoff in Texas over new voting restrictions that gridlocked the state capitol for 38 consecutive days ended Thursday when some Democrats who fled to Washington, D.C. dropped their holdout, paving the way for Republicans to resume pushing an elections overhaul. It abruptly and messily drew to a close one of the few and lengthiest quorum breaks in modern Texas history. Instead of a unified and celebratory return by Democrats, some members lashed out at their colleagues over what they criticized as breaking ranks. Many of the proposed changes to Texas voting that Democrats have railed against for months remain in a bill already passed by the state Senate, and Republican Governor Greg Abbott could now sign the legislation in a matter of weeks, if not sooner. Only 3 new Democrats showed up Thursday, meaning the vast majority of the more than 50 Democrats who bolted for the nation's capital in July continue to stay away from the Texas capital. Still, Republican House Speaker Dade Phelan said enough were there to achieve a quorum, which in the House is normally 100 present legislators. Growing impatience among Republicans had led to escalating threats that missing lawmakers could face arrest, but officers never appeared to do more than leave warrants at Democrats' homes. Quote, "It's been a very long summer. Been through a lot. I appreciate you all being here," Phelan said. "It's time to get back to the business of the people of Texas." End quote. The 3 Democrats who returned to the Texas House defended their decision, saying they had successfully pushed Congress on voting rights legislation and pointing to the growing urgency of surging COVID-19 cases in Texas. One of them, Democrat Garnett Coleman of Houston, did not go to Washington because he was recovering from having a leg amputation brought on by an infection. The Associated Press also reports in today's Gazette, U.S. struggles to speed Kabul airlift despite chaos. The United States struggled Thursday to pick up the pace of American and Afghan evacuations at Kabul Airport, constrained by obstacles ranging from armed Taliban checkpoints to paperwork problems. With an August 31st deadline looming, tens of thousands remain to be airlifted from the chaotic country. Taliban fighters and their checkpoints ringed the airport, major barriers for Afghans who fear that their past work with Westerners makes them prime targets for retribution. Hundreds of Afghans who lacked any papers or clearance for evacuation also congregated outside the airport, adding to the chaos that has prevented even some Afghans who do have papers and promises of flights from getting through. It didn't help that many of the Taliban fighters could not read the documents. In a hopeful sign, State Department spokesman Ned Price said in Washington that 6,000 people were cleared for evacuation Thursday and were expected to board military flights in coming hours. That would mark a major increase from recent days. About 2,000 passengers were flown out on each of the past 2 days, Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said. Kirby said the military has aircraft available to evacuate 5,000 to 9,000 people per day, but until Thursday, far fewer designated evacuees had been able to reach and then enter the airport. Kirby told reporters the limiting factor has been available evacuees, not aircraft. He said efforts were underway to speed processing, including adding State Department consular officers to verify paperwork of Americans and Afghans who managed to get to the airport. Additional entry gates had been opened, he said. And yet, at the current rate, it would be difficult for the U.S. to evacuate all of the Americans and Afghans who are qualified for and seeking evacuation by August 31st. President Joe Biden said Wednesday he would ensure no American was left behind, even if that meant staying beyond August, an arbitrary deadline that he set weeks before the Taliban climaxed a stunning military victory by taking Kabul last weekend. It was not clear if Biden might consider extending the deadline for evacuees who aren't American citizens. At the airport, military evacuation flights continued, but access remained difficult for many. On Thursday, Taliban militants fired into the air to try to control the crowds gathered at the airport's blast walls. Men, women, and children fled. U.S. Navy fighter jets flew overhead, a standard military precaution, but also a reminder to the Taliban that the U.S. has firepower to respond to a combat crisis. There is no accurate figure of the number of people, Americans, Afghans, or others, who need evacuation. And returning to news in Iowa, Tyler Jett of the Register writes, Winnebago moves corporate headquarters to Minnesota. Winnebago is changing addresses, though company leaders say the move won't impact Iowa workers. After its board signed off on the proposal Wednesday, Winnebago Industries will shift its corporate headquarters from Forest City to Minneapolis suburb Eden Prairie, Minnesota in December. The manufacturer of boats, motorhomes, and travel trailers had been headquartered in Forest City since its founding in 1958. The company said in a news release that the corporate move will not lead to much noticeable change. The company's top executives, including CEO Michael Happ, former head of the Minneapolis-based Toro Company, a lawnmower manufacturer, have been based in Eden Prairie since 2016. Spokesperson Chad Reese said the company expects to continue producing vehicles in northern Iowa, where Winnebago employs about 2,100 workers in Charles City, Forest City, Lake Mills, and Waverly. Reese said company leaders only wanted to change the address, quote, to align with where the executive offices are, end quote. Quote, it's a small executive office, he said. We're not anticipating anybody moves, at least not at this time, end quote. Sam Jeffson, another Winnebago spokesperson, said the move will not impact Iowa's tax base. He said the manufacturer pays income tax in the state based on revenue from sales to Iowa dealerships. Iowa Department of Revenue spokesperson John Fuller said he could not comment on any tax changes for an individual filer like Winnebago. Local economic development leaders said they also didn't expect Winnebago's announcement to hurt employment in the area. Hancock County Economic Development Director Jill Kramer said the executive's moves to Minnesota 5 years ago only involved a handful of employees. Quote, Winnebago has been a great partner, and I don't see them abandoning Forest City at all, she said. The company announced just 2 years ago that it would hire 175 workers in Forest City as it moved production of large diesel motorhomes there from Oregon. The company also announced a $500,000 donation to a new career center at Forest City's North Iowa Area Community College in November. Winnebago's Forest City campus is twice as large as any of its other locations, with 36 buildings encompassing 2 million square feet. In addition to motorhomes, the company makes custom vehicles in Forest City, including rolling health clinics that some hospitals use in poor communities. The company has another 4 factories in Charles City, Lake Mills, and Waverly. Quote, it's a huge footprint, Forest City Economic Development Director Beth Bilyeu said, and you don't walk away from things like that, end quote. Let's turn now to the Insight page in Friday's Gazette. At the top of the page is the Gazette's editorial, titled, Rethink Police Oversight in Marion. Marion leaders are reluctant to move forward on instituting a citizen review board of police. We hope they reconsider. The city last year took up a commitment to promote equity in local policing. One proposal is a citizen review board to vet complaints and guide city policy. At a community equity task force meeting last week, staffers downplayed the value of the idea. Quote, there aren't events or data to justify a citizen review board in this city that I've heard about. There have been no shootings, no physical abuse issues, said Tom Newkirk, a civil rights lawyer hired as a consultant for the task force. Why wait for a tragedy to bolster citizen oversight? The idea that only a catastrophic case of police misconduct would necessitate a citizen review board takes a very narrow view of the potential such boards have. Reviewing complaints against police is just one part of it, along with analyzing data on a regular basis and providing policy recommendations. City officials are emphasizing their work to increase data collection about officer conduct and promote access to body camera footage. That's great, and it would be even better if there were a citizen body tasked with reviewing those materials. Review boards in Iowa are extremely limited in the role they can play in officer discipline, as critics of the idea in Marion recently pointed out. It might take significant changes to the law to establish an adequate level of accountability. That underscores the need for more municipal review boards of police, limited as their scope might currently be. Review boards can be useful mechanisms to study the current law and establish legislative advocacy priorities. A statewide network of review boards would be most effective, and Marion would add a valuable voice as a smaller city than Des Moines and Iowa City. The Community Equity Task Force, established last year during the Black Lives Matter protest movement, seemingly has struggled so far to make tangible progress and define the parameters of its work. Advocates at the recent meeting lamented, quote, just sitting and watching PowerPoints, end quote, and, quote, all this lawyer talk, end quote. Establishing a citizen review board of police would be a good way to set the task force's vision in motion. Again, this is the Gazette's editorial in today's Gazette. In letters to the editor, Sherry Flatt of Dubuque writes, "We like bacon, but not corporate agriculture." In a recent Facebook post, Representative Ashley Hinson spoke of her bill, EATS, exposing Agricultural Trade Suppression Act, alleviating what she calls, quote, unconstitutional regulation, end quote. California has passed a law banning the sale of pork born to sows spending their pregnancies in small crates, unable to stand up, lie down, turn, or stretch. Whole Foods, McDonald's, Walmart, and 50-plus other companies agree. She claims it's an attack on, quote, anyone that likes bacon for breakfast, end quote, calling it radical and ridiculous. She ignores that Iowans themselves are trying to clean up the pork industry run mostly by large corporations, not family farmers. The hogs are cruelly kept in concentrated animal feed operations, inches apart and smelled by neighbors miles away. Manure is allowed to be spread on fields and in the winter on top of snow melting into rivers, streams, and our below-ground water supply. Hinson loves the word radical, so I'll turn it on her. Her bill is a radical effort to ignore the great harm done to Iowa's environment in order to put bacon on her table. If she refuses to help clean up the Iowa pork industry, I applaud California's refusing to be part of the mess. Signed, Sherry Flatt of Dubuque. In today's At Liberty column, Adam Sullivan writes, Iowa ready to help Afghan refugees. As the federal government rushes to evacuate Americans and allies from a Taliban-controlled Afghanistan, many are wondering why we didn't start this process sooner. Special visas for Afghans who aided the U.S. have been bogged down by bureaucratic inaction for many months. The military apparently did not plan for the likelihood that the capital of Kabul would fall so quickly. As a result, thousands of friends to the U.S. are languishing in the war-torn nation. One explanation for the chaos is political calculus. President Joe Biden's administration reportedly feared Afghan refugees would become a domestic political burden. Sources say, quote, the White House let political fear of GOP attacks make them act too cautiously on relocating Afghans to the U.S., political journalists wrote this week. Some insiders blame the situation, quote, on White House concern that the influx would invite partisan political backlash amid a rush of migrants at the southern border, the Washington Post reported. Setting aside the grim inhumanity of turning tragedy into a political calculation, the calculation turned out to be wrong. Outside a handful of hardcore nativists, there is little opposition to resettling Afghans in the United States, even among GOP politicians. State and federal officials from Iowa say the state is ready and willing to accept refugees. Quote, we are pushing, pushing, pushing to get as many Afghans out of Afghanistan as we can, and we'd love to have them here in Iowa, U.S. Senator Joni Ernst told reporters at the Iowa State Fair this week, as reported by Radio Iowa. Quote, I think the message that I want to relay to Iowans is we want to be a partner. We want them here, Governor Kim Reynolds said, per Radio Iowa. Republican governors of Maryland, Massachusetts, Oklahoma, Vermont, and Utah have also said their states are ready to assist Afghan refugees. The focus for now is on recipients of special immigration visas designated for Afghans who assisted the military. There are hundreds of thousands of other Afghans who would benefit from resettlement, not to mention many more in other countries. Perhaps Afghanistan can be a clarifying moment in Americans' acceptance of refugees. Refugees arriving in Iowa are assisted through a network of resettlement programs, including the Catherine McCauley Center in Cedar Rapids. The organization has not served Afghan refugees to date, but is prepared to do so. Refugees are set up with rental housing and meet regularly with advocates during the 90-day placement period. They get help to apply for benefits, seek health care, enroll kids in school and adults in English classes, and look for work. Providing those services is not only the right thing to do, it's a wise investment that pays dividends economically, socially, and culturally. Refugees make our communities more productive and more vibrant. Quote, there is data aplenty that refugees and immigrants pay more in taxes and contribute more to the local economy than they ever receive over the course of their lifetimes, said Sarah Zetjinik, a refugee services director at the Catherine McCauley Center. Quote, but there's a value that can't always be quantified to the diversity that refugees and immigrants bring to our communities. End quote. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, August 20th, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Mary J. Cahill, aged 88, of Tulsa, Oklahoma, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died on Wednesday, August 11th. Graveside services at 10 a.m. Saturday, August 21st, at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Arrangements are with Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service in Cedar Rapids. Mary was born December 4th, 1932, in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Ronald and Hazel Krause Lacey. She graduated from Roosevelt High School in 1949. On January 11, 1950, Mary married Patrick Cahill in Tacoma, Washington. She retired from Rockwell Collins in 1984 and moved to Oklahoma, where she worked for Murphy's Electronics in Tulsa for a short time. Please share your support and memories with Mary's family on her tribute wall at stuartbaxter.com. Dolores Clauda Leach was a loving wife, mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, sister, and friend. She passed away on Saturday, July 17th, following complications from an ongoing illness at the age of 85. She was born to George A. Clauda and Elsie Rochar Clauda on September 3, 1935, in Ely, Iowa. An adept student, Dolores graduated with honors, first from Lakeside Country School, then Marion High School, in 1953. She proceeded to attain her bachelor's degree in education from Coe College and shared her love of learning as an elementary school teacher in the Linn County area for many years. On June 10, 1962, she was wed to Gary E. Leach in Cedar Rapids. Always humble and helping others without expecting anything in return, Dolores was a light in the lives of many, and her smile, laughter, and loving presence will be dearly missed. A cremation will take place, followed by a private graveside service at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be sent to the Cedar Rapids Community Health Free Clinic. Richard Max Stewart, known as Dick, aged 81, of Peoria, Arizona, formerly of Westchester, Iowa, passed peacefully on Sunday, August 15th, surrounded by his family. A celebration of life service will be held at a later date. Memorials have been established for the Westchester United Methodist Church in Westchester. Memorials may be sent to the family of Richard Stewart, attention, Deidre Stewart Allinger, at 35812 North 7th Street in Phoenix, 85086. Richard was born on September 19, 1939, in Washington, Iowa, the son of Norman Keith and Helen May Niffenegger Stewart. He graduated from Westchester High School in 1957 and American Institute of Business in Des Moines in 1959. On August 26, 1962, Richard was united in marriage to Bonita May Herr at Keota United Methodist Church in Keota. Richard and Bonnie lived in Iowa with their four children until moving to Phoenix in 1989. His wife Bonnie preceded him in death on November 23, 2018. During his years in Iowa, Richard farmed and raised livestock. He was an active member in the Westchester United Methodist Church, and upon moving to Arizona, he worked for Stewart Transport and enjoyed working with his son Colin, owner of Stewart Transport Incorporated. Stewart Transport Incorporated. Jebril James Brown. On Friday, August 13th, Jebril James Brown, our loving son, brother, grandson, fiancé, father, uncle, and friend, passed away at the age of 30. He was born November 20th, 1990, in Cedar Rapids, to James Brown and Yela Knight. Jebril was a foodie and gamer whose passions in life were his children and living life to the fullest. He was a happy, fun-loving, smiley baby who grew into a lovely man with a heart of gold. He was employed at the family business, Marion Iron, his entire career as a manager, and will be missed dearly by many. Jabril is survived by his mother, Yila, and her husband, Phil Knight, his father, James, and his wife, and Jabril's stepmother, Rayanne, his sister, Kathleen, Kate, known as Kate Brown, his fiancée, Kelly Wagner, and their two children, Phoenix and Stone. A celebration of life will be held from 3 to 6 p.m. Saturday, August 21st at Daniels Park Splash Pad Pavilion, 904 Oakland Road Northeast in Cedar Rapids. Alice Fitzpatrick, aged 75, of Marion, died Wednesday, August 18th at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. A celebration of life will take place at a later date, as well as burial at Maplewood Cemetery in Vinton. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids assisted the family. Alice was born April 24, 1946, in San Francisco, the daughter of Algie and Clara Josephine Goodwin Long. She married James Fitzpatrick in Iowa City on December 29, 1967. James passed away in 2012. Alice worked at Methwick as an oral medical technician and Kmart before the couple eventually moved to Missouri. Please share a memory of Alice at the website murdochfuneralhome.com. Wilbur R. Lingle, known as Bud, age 92, of Solon, passed away peacefully in his home on Tuesday, August 17th. Celebration of Life gathering will be from 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday, August 22nd at Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Solon, lower level, located at 100 South Cedar Street. Military graveside services will be 10 a.m. Monday, August 23rd at Oakland Cemetery in Solon, conducted by the Ely American Legion. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Solon is in charge of arrangements. Wilbur was born January 27, 1929, in Solon, the son of Rudolph S. and Clara E. Reif Lingle. He served in the U.S. Army during the Korean conflict from 1951 to 1953. Bud was united in marriage to Doris E. Juratek on October 28, 1954, in Ely. Bud farmed in the Solon and Ely area most of his life. He was a longtime member of the Ely American Legion, Post 555, the Odd Fellows, and had served as the Big Grove Township clerk for over 31 years. He was also a bass guitar player for the Herald and His Hawkeyes, Iowa Rangers, and Country Time Country. Bud is survived by his children, Jeff Lingle of Coralville and Sue and Drew Smith of Hiawatha. Grandchildren, and his companion, Phyllis Fiala of Solon. Memorials may be directed to either the Solon Fire Building Fund or to the Iowa City Hospice in his name. Online condolences may be expressed to the family at the website brushchapel.com. Maxine L. Akey Blinks Hatcher, age 90, of Lisbon, died on Wednesday, August 18th, at her home. Family and friends will gather for a celebration of her life from 3 to 5 p.m. Sunday, August 22nd, at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon. Maxine was born March 27, 1931, on the family farm southeast of Sutliff to Merle and Thelma Keller Akey. She attended the country school called Coon Creek, then graduated valedictorian in 1948 from Lisbon High School. Maxine graduated from Teachers College, UNI, with a certificate making it possible to teach in rural schools. She returned to teach in the Coon Creek School where she had attended as a young girl. In December of 1951, Maxine married John Blinks. Five children were born to this union. They later divorced. In May of 1979, she married Hubert Hatcher and was blessed with a second family. She worked at several local care centers before going to work for Rockwell Goss, retiring in 1996 after 18 years. Please share your support and memories with Maxine's family on her tribute wall at the website stuartbaxter.com. James Robert Elijah, aged 74, of Lindenhurst, Illinois, passed away peacefully on August 13th at the village at Victory Lakes in Lindenhurst. Jim was born December 2, 1946, in Cedar Rapids to Robert and Thelma Harness Elijah. He graduated from Clarence High School in 1965. Jim went to college and got a degree in education at Cornell College in Mount Vernon and a master's in school counseling from Northeastern Illinois University. Later, he moved to Chicago and taught at Evergreen Park High School, was a guidance counselor at St. Rita High School, and later went on to finish his years at Adlai E. Stevenson High School, from where he retired after 28 years. Jim was preceded in death by his parents, Robert and Thelma. There will be a private family burial at the Clarence Cemetery. Condolences can be sent to Jerry Elijah, 209 East 8th Street, Tipton, Iowa, 52772, or William Elijah, 680 Spicer Avenue, Clarence, Iowa, 52216. Chapman Funeral Home has Jim's family in their care. Memorials and condolences may be shared at the website chapmanfh.com. Jimmy Wheeler, known as Jim, aged 83, of Tiffin in Osage Beach, Missouri, formerly of West Branch, passed away Wednesday, August 18th, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Memorial visitation will be held from 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday, August 22nd, at the Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Branch, where a celebration of life will be held immediately following at 4 p.m. Online condolences may be made to the family at hendersonbarkerfuneralhome.com. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to West Branch Booster Club or an animal shelter of the donor's choice. Jimmy Lee Wheeler was born October 5, 1937, in Olwine, the son of Roderick and Corrine Atkinson Wheeler. He was a graduate of Olwine High School in the class of 1955 and attended Iowa State Teachers College in Cedar Falls from 1955 to 1956. In 1957, he joined the U.S. Army, serving until 1958. Following his service to his country, he attended Parsons College, receiving his B.A. in 1962. On December 27, 1959, he was united in marriage to Patricia Daniels in Council Bluffs. Jim began his teaching career in 1962 with the Mid Prairie School System until 1966, when he moved to West Branch and continued teaching and coaching until his retirement in 1996. During his coaching career, he received many awards and received recognition on the local, state, and national level, taking the girls' basketball, softball, and golf teams to state, as well as taking the boys' golf game teams to state and winning four consecutive years, 1989 to 1992. He was Iowa Coach of the Year in 1993 and 96, Midwest Coach of the Year in 1996, and finalist for National Coach of the Year in 1996. He was inducted into the Iowa Coaches Hall of Fame in 2002. During his time as a teacher, he mentored 26 student teachers and taught driver's education for 20 years, stating he had driven, quote, around the world three times with new drivers, end quote. He is survived by his wife Pat of Tiffin, three children, Robin Hennis of Oxford, Terry Schuchard of Coralville, and Chris Wheeler of Marion. Daryl James Kessner, aged 87, of Vinton, formerly of Newhall, passed away peacefully on August 17th at the Keystone Care Center after battling Parkinson's disease for more than a decade. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. August 22nd at St. John Lutheran Church in Newhall. Daryl's life will be honored at 10 a.m. Monday, August 23rd at St. John Lutheran Church in Newhall, where he was a lifelong member. Christian burial will take place at St. John Lutheran Church Cemetery. Daryl was born on March 3, 1934, in Vinton, to Ball and Bernice Duncalf Kessner. Raised with four siblings on a farm, Daryl graduated from Newhall Consolidated School in 1952. He served his country in the U.S. Navy and married the love of his life, Clarice Ireland, while stationed in Long Beach, California. Together, they raised four children on the family farm near Newhall. After 4 decades of farming, Daryl and Clarice enjoyed annual treks to Port Isabel, Texas, where they helped build a church and made countless friends. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions in honor of Daryl may be made directly to St. John Lutheran Church in Newhall or the St. Croix Hospice. Online condolences may be left at phillipsfuneralhomes.com. Brian O. Pruitt passed away on August 12th of pneumonia caused by COVID-19. Born February 3, 1974, he was only 47 years old. Loved by many for his fun-loving nature and hard, honest work, Brian enjoyed golfing, fishing, camping, and watching some good old football. He is survived by his 2 children, daughter Brianna Pruitt and son Taylor Pruitt, and a loving partner, Danelle Verba, all here in Iowa. He is also survived in his home state of Florida by his family, including a sister and brother-in-law, niece and nephew, grandniece, brother and mother. He has many beloved friends and family members near and far. Celebration of life event details to be determined. Mark Richard Cruz, aged 64, of Tipton, and often called Doc by his friends, passed away August 18th. A memorial service will be held Saturday, August 28th, at Trinity Lutheran Church in Tipton, with visitation at 10 a.m. and service at 11 a.m. Online condolences may be shared at fryfuneralhome.com. Mark was born July 19, 1957, to Dr. Otto and Verna Cruz in Tipton. He graduated from Tipton High School, attended Kirkwood Community College, then survived Guillain-Barre. He fought hard and was able to come back from total paralysis to walk again. He worked as a mechanic, landscaper, farmhand, shoe repair and sales, and later worked at Cruz Construction with his brothers. Mark was selfless, a kind and giving soul. Those who were fortunate to know him knew of his huge heart and that he would do anything for you. Left to miss his humor and that special twinkle in his eyes are his mother, Verna Cruz of Tipton, brothers Craig of Minneapolis, Bill of Cresco, Dave of Tipton, and Eric of Tipton, a sister, Annie, of Mount Vernon, and numerous nieces and nephews. Memorials can be directed to Friends of the Animals in Tipton. That concludes the obituaries in Friday's Gazette. Turning to the sports page in Friday's Gazette, in minor league baseball, Colonels rally in the 9th inning. This is a short photo essay with 3 photos, the first of which shows Cedar Rapids Colonels starting pitcher Tyler Watson as he unleashes a pitch during the 2nd inning of a game against the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers last night at Veterans Memorial Stadium in Cedar Rapids. Entering the bottom of the 9th inning, down 8-7, the Colonels rallied for 2 runs to post a 9-8 victory over the visiting Timber Rattlers. Wander Javier's single scored, pinch runner Daniel Osorio winning with the winning run. In another photograph, Cedar Rapids Colonels Jefferson Morales slides into third base safely on a sacrifice fly from Gabriel Maciel, as the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers third baseman Jason Coca fields the ball during the 2nd inning at Veterans Memorial Stadium in Cedar Rapids. In another photograph, Cedar Rapids Colonels first baseman Edward Julian connects for a 2-run single during the 2nd. The lead story in the Gazette's sports page features high school football 8-player preview. This is an article by K.J. Piltzer of the Gazette entitled "Enjoy the Show." Montezuma looks to duplicate last season's football success. Eddie Burgess conveyed a final message about the upcoming football season. Quote, "Enjoy the show," the All-State quarterback said about third-ranked Montezuma, which opens the season at Iowa Valley on Saturday. The Braves returned their dynamic signal caller and all-around playmaker, the guys in the trenches, and some talent ready to fill the void left by All-State receivers Trey Shearer and Cole Watts from a team that led the state with 3,882 passing yards and 97 total touchdowns. Quote, we've got three great wide receivers this year, Burgess said. It's going to be the same story, just different people, if I'm being honest. Quote, people don't think we have as good athletes as Cole and Trey. Obviously, Cole and Trey are two of the best wide receivers that came through 8-man. We're just going to reload, pick it up, and go. End quote. Montezuma posted a 10-1 record last season, winning a district title and reaching the 8-player state semifinals. It was one of the program's most successful seasons and the best finish since a Class 1A runner-up performance in 2006. Quote, the boys are working hard, Montezuma first-year head coach John Beck said. They had a great summer. We averaged most of our team in the weight room. When it comes to what we have coming back, I think we're going to have a pretty good season. I think we're going to contend for a district title and a playoff spot, and who knows what will happen when we get there. End quote. Beck has been on staff as an assistant, so he was able to make a smooth transition. He knows what he is inheriting, especially with Burgess. Burgess has shattered the record books, producing statistics last season that equals two careers for many. He amassed 5,094 all-purpose yards with 89 total touchdowns. Burgess threw for 3,803 yards and 59 scores. Burgess also led the Braves with 91 total tackles and 77 solo and 13 for loss. Quote, he is basically like an extra coach on the field, Beck said. He knows our offense inside and out. He knows how to get the ball wherever we need to get it. If there is a hole open, he'll run it down the middle. Defensively, he was our leader, too. He makes the checks and all the things we need. We're looking for him to do some big things for us. End quote. Burgess has focused on getting stronger and quicker this season. The 6'4", 230-pounder addressed being a better leader. Quote, I need to be better overall, Burgess said. Quote, even the young kids on our team, they need help and guidance, so becoming a better leader is what will change me the most this year. I'm excited to see what we have coming. End quote. The top three targets graduated. Shearer, Watts, and Cody Strong accounted for 188 receptions and 3,608 yards. The Braves will rely on Connor Van Zee, Mason Shearer, Owen Cook, and Eli Bustamante to pick up the slack and the other end of Burgess' passes. Experience is prominent in the trenches. The Braves return all three starters on the offensive line, two-year center Kenan Redcap, T.J. Townsend, and Jack Brenner. Todd Geiger made a semifinal start offensively and was a second-team defensive lineman. Marty Knox, Zach Bennett, and Camden Michalik could also make an impact. Quote, we've had some good competition with our offensive and defensive line, Beck said. All those guys look to play a major role to our offensive line. In the Gazette's Living section, today's Commit to Be Fit column, written by Kylie Alger, is titled Struggling with Waves of Collective Grief. After a hectic morning with my kids, I found myself frustrating and needed to get out of the house, so I decided to pack all the kids in the car and go for a ride to clear my head. We stepped outside, and my 4-year-old pointed up to the sky. Mom, look at the sun. It's so red. I looked up and saw a hazy red sun burning in the sky, and instead of admiring it like my children were, my heart instantly dropped. To my kids, this red sun looked really cool, but knowing the sun looked this vibrant red because of the intense wildfires across the country made me sad. Suddenly, the little inconveniences from my morning were trivial in comparison to what I knew others were going through. Feeling helpless, I closed my eyes tight and said a prayer for those affected by the wildfires. As I was driving, I couldn't keep myself from squinting up at the red sun. I kept thinking about how hundreds of miles away, under the same sun, people were losing their homes to raging wildfires. We were under the same sun, but having vastly different days. I was feeling this immense sadness and helplessness for those around the world who were experiencing such a different reality. It reminded me of similar feelings I had while watching the peak of COVID-19 in the news, witnessing the racial injustice and civil disorder we experienced last year, and now my heart is aching for people in Afghanistan and Haiti. These terrible national tragedies can lead to feelings of so-called collective grief. Acknowledging and naming grief has been suggested by experts to be an important step in processing loss in a healthy and productive way. Collective grief happens when a community, society, village, or nation experiences extreme change or loss, such as natural disasters, war, mass casualties, pandemics, or any other widespread devastation. quote, like individual grief, there is a feeling of lack of control that comes with collective grief. We were unable to prevent the loss or change, and we feel powerless in its wake, said Asma Raymond, counselor and a certified grief recovery specialist. Quote, and not only do we experience this collective grief after any time of national crisis, but we also feel what is known as anticipatory grief as the crisis continues on. Anticipatory grief is that feeling we get when we are, in a way, preemptively mourning and grieving. We see the loss around us, and we see that the problems have not been fixed, so we know more is coming down the line. End quote. As a country and as a world, we have been experiencing relentless waves of collective grief. Learning about collective grief has helped me to better understand my feelings and realize I am not alone in feeling this way. It has also put a name to the struggling emotions I feel while watching the news. Sometimes the only thing I feel like I can do is pray. As schools reopen and we continue to venture into our so-called new normal, may we always be kind to one another and pray for everyone living under the same sun. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, August 20th. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening.